We'll need a copy of Does a Perfect Mind and a blank piece of paper. Okay, Does a Perfect Mind. I just told folks briefly yesterday as we were giving an overview of the weekend. Does a Perfect Mind is a document from what's called the Nag Hammadi Library. So the Nag Hammadi Library. How many of you know about the Nag Hammadi Library?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, a couple. It was a jar in the Egyptian desert that was found in 1945 that had 52 books, 40 of which had never been known before, all of which, more or less, seemed to be a part of some kind of Christ movement of the first or second century. So it was a massive discovery. 52 books, 40 of which hadn't been even heard of before. Lots to say about that big thing, but one of them was called the Thunder Perfect Mind. See, only it was one of the 40 that had never been known before, and belongs to some kind of early Christ group. We're going to be looking at the Thunder Perfect Mind. It's probably the second or third most famous of the 52 Nag Hammadi discoveries. Probably the most famous is the Gospel of Thomas, complete Gospel of Thomas. The Thunder Perfect Mind has been, Ridley Scott has made a film about it. Toni Morrison has dedicated two of her books to it, with a citation from it. Foucault's Pendulum has a whole chapter on it. Many musicians have written music to it. I think that I just want us to read it for a little bit. Let's read it out loud, and I'm going to just have us skim and group read it for a while. Yeah, everybody have a copy? You need your own. I'm going to at one point say, everybody read. Then I'm going to say, the women read. Then I'm going to say, the men read, or a man, or two women, or something like that. Okay? All right, let's have everybody read together out loud verses 1 and 2.
I was sent out from power. I came to those pondering me, and I was found among those seeking me. Look at me, all you who contemplate me. Audience, hear me. Those expecting me, receive me.
Now, let's have the women read chapter 2, verse 11 through 13.
Pay attention to me, to my impoverishment, and to my extravagance. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms.
Men 14 and 15.
Do not stare at me when I am thrown out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously.
Everybody together on 16, 17.
I myself am compassionate, and I am cruel. Watch out. Do not hate my compliance, and do not love my restraint. In my weakness, do not strip me bare. Do not be afraid of my power.
Anybody who wants to, 18.
Why do you despise my fear and curse my pride? I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness.
Back to chapter 1, 3, and 4. Anybody who wants to.
Don't chase me from your sight. Don't let your voice or your hearing hate me.
Don't ignore me anyplace, anytime. Be careful. Do not ignore me.
A woman for five.
I am the first and the last. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman.
A man for six.
I am the wife and the virgin. I am he, the mother and the daughter. I am the limbs of my mother.
Everybody for seven and eight.
I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. I am she whose wedding is extravagant, and I didn't have a husband. I am the midwife, and she who has given birth. I am the comfort of my labor pains.
Anyone for nine?
I am the bride and the bridegroom, and it is my husband who gave birth to me. I am my father's mother, my husband's sister, and he is my child.
Anybody for 10?
I am the slave woman of him who served me. I am she, the Lord of my child.
All right, that's enough to think about. all right, so nobody had ever had any of these thoughts written down until the Nagamati collection was found and the Thunder Book of Mind was translated. Just a couple of words about this. As we're going to go into a reading exercise about halfway through, which will be mostly meditation of our own. But so we more or less know what we might say what this genre of ancient literature is, and it's basically the genre of the divine person revealing her or himself.
Versus what?
Revealing her or himself. So it's a divine person speaking in the first person singular as a divine person. Talking about her or his divinity. By the way, all of these pronoun and gender-bended pronouns in this text that's not some fancy modern translation. That's all in the Coptic. In fact, very literally translated from the Coptic. So by the way, you know this kind of literature in the Bible. For instance, in Exodus 3, God reveals God's self to Moses, I am that I am, or I am who I am. Then Jesus speaks like this in one gospel in the New Testament. Anyone know which one that is?
John,
yeah. I'm the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the light of the world. There's a total of 12 in which Jesus speaks as a divine figure, self-revealing, God's self to in the particular person. The Thunder Perfect Mind, however, along probably with the Gospel of John, are different than almost all of the other that are called eratologies, is the name of the self-revealing speech of a divine figure, an eratology. All of the ancient eratologies, or I am speeches, are alike except for these two, in that the divine figure in everything else is perfect, all-powerful, and knows it all. So for instance, in the Hebrew scriptures, in Hebrew, the figure of wisdom speaks of herself, and she knows everything and can do everything. The Egyptian figure of Isis, the goddess Isis from the ancient world, she speaks, that we have 25 different speeches of her in which she claims that she's the most beautiful, the best, the most powerful, the only. Here, we have a difference. Mainly, is that this is a very vulnerable deity. Did you notice how she talks? She's afraid of being thrown to the ground. All of that section in chapter 2. She's in the shit pile. She is thrown out among the condemned. She's among those who've been slaughtered viciously. She is stripped bare. I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness. So this is actually not the way a Mediterranean divinity speaks and acts in the ancient world, because it's vulnerable. Bad things happen to this divinity, and this divinity is vulnerable and wounded. So Isis would never be like this. Isis is way too powerful and way too knowing. The figure of wisdom, similarly, also in Proverbs, is that. So this is really quite interesting, especially in terms of the text we're looking at this weekend, that here is a vulnerable divinity who proclaims herself that way and other ways, right? So in many ways, of course, I am the first and the last. As I said yesterday, that's straight out of the revelation to John, as Jesus being a relatively all-powerful divine presence. But something happens here in this text to have this as, and you'll see, I think not too far from Jesus and Mark, the way we were talking this morning. But here, this is a divine figure, self-revealing, proud of herself, saying, you better listen to me. Don't stop hearing. It's time. And at the same time, quite vulnerable. The next thing I hope you notice is how much she is female. Right? So she's primarily female. Did you notice in this little section, there was one time in which we met this figure as male, and that was very gender-bended.
She was giving birth or something?
Just sit look at it.
I am he,
the mother and the daughter. By the way, this is a translation that I did with one of my graduate students, and is the only English translation with a full book around it about this text. Prior to this, we were very conservative in this translation because we wanted it to be, we knew it was going to be the first book in English, and we wanted it to be not something that we fancy 21st century people made up, but very close to the ancient Coptic. So when we found I Am He the Mother, we were ourselves in queer enough territory, that is, we were very interested in gender bending, that we said, well, let's just let that be. But it turns out that all of our scholarly colleagues made fun of us for translating it that way. Except that I noticed down below that you'll see in verse 11 of 1, we read through 10 and then we'll leave 11. 10 is one of these mind-boggling ones, and we'll talk to it about that in a minute. I am the slave woman, so this is the deity saying, I am the slave woman of him who served me. See that riddle? Mm-hmm. So I am she, the Lord of my child, but it is he who gave birth to me. So it's clearly a mother who is a he in this text. Here it is he that gives birth. Just as you, above you have, I am he, the mother. But mostly a female character. Here, there are two other places in the entire document that we probably won't get to completely, in which this figure becomes he, but in all the rest, maybe 30 or 40 declarations of her as female. And then, I don't know what you noticed this, but let's take a look then up close. In 5, 1-5, meaning chapter 1, verse 5, the second sentence, I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. So, by the way, this figure is pretty constantly humiliated. I am she who is honored and she is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. Now let's take those last three a little bit slower. At first, scholars thought that this was an oppositional thing in each, that these were opposites. It's not quite the case, of course. I mean, I am the whore and the holy woman. That's not quite an opposite. It's a difference. Similarly, I am the wife and the virgin. You wouldn't want to say that's the exact opposite, but it's some difference. Then you go down to 7. I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. Now that's not an opposite, that's a complication, right? In terms of identity. Then below that, I am she whose wedding is extravagant, and I didn't have a husband. There too, this is not an opposite, but it's a tensive, different complication. What scholars have noted over the past 40 years or so that we've been thinking about this is what this text is mostly doing relative to women, regular women, is take the slurs and the contrasts and put them together. So for instance, women are often made, are either the honored one or the mocked one, or either the whore or the holy woman. But this puts them together and basically deconstructs the slanders against women, or the exaggerations about women. So this puts together things that in common parlance are supposed to be different kinds of women. But this puts the I am, puts them together, deconstructing the slanders on it.
So it's not an either or, but a both and.
It's a, yeah, and the both and isn't all inclusive. It's about two tensive categories of experience or slander of women. Mm-hmm. So in other words, this seems to be really interested in actual women, not just mythical, right? So this is a divine figure, but it's a divine figure who associates herself with all kinds of women, especially women that may be humiliated or slandered or shunned or thrown to the ground. It looks like that is one of the interests of this text, is to make that this is a divine character who is more inclusive of different kinds of women, and especially more interesting in deconstructing the women made out to be bad. It's not just, however, women, so turn over, and if you would look in chapter 3, Here's another thing that's not gender bent. So looking at chapter 3, why did you hate me with your schemes? I shall shut my mouth among those whose mouths are shut, and then I will show up and speak. That's about, frankly, that's in some ways a summary of the entire speech. She associates herself with those who can't speak, and then she starts to speak. But then you look at, why then did you hate me, you Greeks? Because I am a barbarian among barbarians? Here, of course, she's taking on the slur again, right? A barbarian. No one in the ancient world wants to be called a barbarian. It's the thing that you're not supposed to or allowed to be. So she, however, is, this is the only place where she says she's only one thing, and that's a barbarian. Among barbarians. So this would be some, you know, something like saying, I am the refugee, or I am the person whose nationality is so different, is only attacked. And then verse 4, I am the wisdom of the Greeks and the knowledge of the barbarians. Notice how twisted that is in this deconstruction. So the barbarians are the stupid ones in their slang. But here, she is the wisdom of the Greeks, who of course are in the caricatures, they're the smart ones, and the knowledge of barbarians. So this turns the categories on their heads, that the Greeks are the smart ones and the barbarians don't know anything. So who she is challenges the slanders and brings together the ones that shouldn't be brought together. Later on in this, she says that she is the foreigner and the city and the citizen of the city at the same time.
Over in 14.
Yeah, it four.
414.
414. Yes, I was going to say. I think it's 414. I am she who's. I am peace. And war exists because of me. I am a foreigner and a citizen of the city. I am being, I am she who is nothing. We're maybe about on overload because this is a kind of discourse that we don't hear. Stop, let's stop, have me stop and have you respond with questions, thoughts, protests.
What's your original language?
Coptic. Well, actually, there's a big argument. We only have it in the Coptic. A lot of scholars say that that it was probably original in the Greek. The problem was when our group of five did this translation, we found word plays in Coptic that we couldn't find how you would get them into Greek. So,
into or from?
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, we tried to translate it back. We noticed, you can only make this joke or this tense of wordplay if it's in Coptic. So we tried to find a way of saying it in Greek and couldn't. There are rhythms and rhymes in this that are in Coptic, and we had a hard time figuring how that would be rhymed in Greek. So. But we're in the minority in that case. So I think most scholars think that it was originally in Greek, and we only have the Coptic version.
What I immediately thought of was the parades with the pussycats, which is just taking...
Yes, the parade of the pussycats. Exactly. Especially if there were a couple of men would be wearing a pussy hat.
Yeah.
That would have the gender benders through the various genders.
It sounds to me like this entity is trying to say, you're so good at dividing and categorizing everyone. Thank you very much, but please don't do that. We are all valued.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. Yeah, that's very important. although it probably is a little bit more edgy in that it keeps picking up these humiliated mock and satires or of figures. Other things to say?
I guess when I first saw this, I thought, this doesn't look like anything I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it seems impossible. Mm-hmm. And then as we look at it and study it and read it and think about it, I think, oh, this is everyone. This is everything. This is completely relatable. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of amused at that dichotomy of being not put off by it, but just finding it different, mm-hmm. and to finding it interesting and almost intimate.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of intimacy in it.
I also think it's interesting that we ourselves are so complicated in that we can be this and then that and then this and then that.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
All in one.
In other words, identity politics never really works all the way, does it?
Right.
In other words, we're all pretty complicated people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it interesting to, well, and this is where we do not know, what was this community like?
Yeah. Yeah.
Has it practiced this?
Yeah. We're going to think a little bit more with it. Susan.
You didn't talk about chapter two, but I just found myself going there. Maybe you did it before I walked in. But
read it first.
You read that?
Yes.
Chapter two?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then you did it. But it just seemed like me. I am both awareness and obliviousness. I am humiliation and pride. I am without shame. I am ashamed. I am security and I am fear. I mean, that just feels like me, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. And the other part of two is so important that we talked about at the beginning. This is really focused on humiliation and violence. So you notice all of that from 11 all the way through 18 is mostly about her being thrown to the ground, her being found among those slaughtered viciously, her being found in a shit pile. And that, by the way, you'll notice, basically most of that doesn't have a glorious side. It's mostly about her being humiliated and hurt. Now, just a little bit more before we get into our own writing. But so a number of scholars have said, this is like John, Jesus in the Gospel of John. And that is, of course, it's only in John that Jesus does this kind of I am speeches. I am the bread of life, for instance. There's an entire chapter on I am the bread of life in the Gospel of John. And at the same time, Jesus is, of course, as in all the other three canonical Gospels, Jesus is tortured to death. So here you have the great I am in both of these texts being humiliated and being divine. Remember, some of those of you who are here this morning, the main aim in crucifixion was to humiliate hundreds of thousands of people. You take them into a public space, you put them to death, but really, really slowly. So people can watch you die for days, and then you let the body hang so the birds and the dogs eat the body. So in other words, what's really interesting is that we have in this jar, in Nag Hammadi, the 52 documents and the 40 that we didn't even know about before, they're all associated with Christ in one way or another, except this one. In other words, actively, we don't have Jesus in any of this. But what we're thinking about more and more is this may be Jesus anyway. I mean, it's in the Jesus jar. Everything else is about Jesus. And so why would it be there if it's not about Jesus? That might, it might be that it was, this is the way Jesus literature goes anyway, right? It could have been originally not about Jesus, and then the community said, no, it is about Jesus. And of course we know that Jesus is also compared in the New Testament to the divine female figure of wisdom. So the gender bendedness also can be.
Wouldn't that run under the appropriation of authority, saying this goes into the Jesus job, even if it isn't?
Say a little bit more.
That you try to prove your point by relating to outside authority, older writings, like our theology developed that way a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. The wrinkle there is that this seems to be not, in other words, if it would be Isis, who is so powerful and knows, this is a humiliated divinity. So that wouldn't give you too much credits. It wouldn't give you more credibility if Jesus was associated with a flawed, humiliated divinity. But I think that there's some of it. I mean, I am the first and the last. That can give Jesus some credit, if that's where you're going.
What is it kind of skip things at the bit?
Remember yesterday?
No.
I'm sorry. Yesterday, when I told the larger story of the Nag Hammadi jar, the short version of this part of it is, so these two farmers found it in the desert, took it home to their house, left it outside, because it was just books. And then their mom said that when it was cold, let's start a fire, could you get some of that papyrus out of the jar and start a fire? And indeed, so a bunch of the parts of the documents were destroyed in that fire. And if you have ever seen, and you can go online, for instance, go online and see the oldest copy of the Gospel of Thomas, and you'll see that almost all of them have little holes in them. And in fact, that happens for all the manuscripts we have, the earliest manuscripts we have of the New Testament, all have holes in them. So we have to look at a bunch of different manuscripts to put it together. Those are what we call lacunae, the holes. The fancy word for hole.
What's the fancy word?
Lacunae.
Lacuna.
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 Yeah, lacuna. I've done this, now for almost 10 years with this text, and I'm going to do it with you too. It's always different. But so this is the Great I Am speaking, right? But this is Great I Am, I think, both in the Gospel of John and in the Thunder Perfect Mind, is really interested in the ordinary parts of life being associated with the divinity. Like Susan said, it's really interested in not being especially logical, but being more experiential. In other words, things that don't quite go together get put in the same sentence. Very interested in real human beings, especially real women. So my invitation to you for the next 10 or so minutes would be to write your I Am in this style.
Oh my gosh.
Write who you are. You don't have to read it afterwards. But let the freedom of this document, which allows contradictions and opposites and humiliation and power and love and tenderness all to be mixed up together, So the outrageousness of this request on my part is that we let down our guard and write not only our logical coherences, but our incoherences and our contradictions. The second is that it asks us to think of ourselves as divine. So in other words, let yourself feel divine power inside you. And be also open to, at the same time, remembering the humility, the loss, and the violence. Just as many I ams as you can get. Everybody have a piece of paper to write it. I took right on. If you want, you can consult the document, but I'd prefer you to mostly consult yourself. Give a few more moments, but if you'd like to, turn also to the Thunder Perfect Mind and just underline words that speak for you. So continue with your I am and or spend some time with the thunder. Let's come back together. So one of the things I'm aware of, having done this with people for the last decade, and every time they do it, I do it, not under the same. I'm aware that even though I say we won't have to read it, in some cases it turns out that some of the things you write, you want to say out loud. So I'm going to invite two kinds of things that you can say. I'm totally comfortable with no one saying anything. But I want to ask you if you want to speak either of an I am that you've written, not all of it, but a phrase or two, or if there's something, just one of the phrases in the thunder, maybe that's not quite you, but maybe you wish it were you, or you're glad it's not, or you're afraid of it might be. We'll have a little bit of time to also talk afterwards, but let's take just a few minutes. We'll start in silence, since you'll want to seriously give weight to the fact you may not want to say it. I am deeply wounded, somewhat healed, a danger to others, and a flower about to blossom.
I am holy and unwhole.
I am the daughter and the sister without a sister or a mother.
I am a doer and a thinker.
In my true self, do not tell me who you think I am.
I am he, the mother.
I am king of the pristine mountain, aware of all in my view. I am lower than the cockles buried in the putrid mud and blind to all who seek me. I am alone in the crowd. I am the crowd.
I am bread and I hunger.
I am judgment and acquittal.
Text. I am she who is timid, and I am safe in a comfortable place. I am witness, and I am wise.
Also from the piece, advance towards childhood. Do not hate it, because it is small and insignificant.
Thank you. So let's just take a step back from being in the text, but just notice anything we want to about how it was to be there. I want to say that one of my interests, and I say this because I'm in a place that is not only, but is Christian, I'm really interested in how us feeling like we are a part of Jesus has been taken from us by a kind of dogmatic Christianity. And so, one of the things that I hope, that I kind of fantasize about the ancient people who wrote this and put it in the Jesus jar, was it was a way of helping them also be in some kind of Jesus divinity. That's thoughtful. Just anything you want to say about how it was to be inside that text as you? Yes.
Well, I had a really hard time imagining myself as divine. So are you saying it would be in the Jesus jar because Jesus was like us, a human? Or?
Something like that. I think you're saying, and this has a lot to do with the other texts that we did the last two times and that are coming. I think that liberal Christianity has got so frightened of calling Jesus divine, that it's been easier to call Jesus just human. So it feels to me like a bunch of that stuff in the ancient first and second century thought that humans were also divine in Jesus. And so I'm trying to see whether I'm comfortable with that or not. I identify with you and say, oh, I'm kind of scared to think that I'm divine. Partly because, you know, so many people do think they're divine and are kind of nasty. Or something
like
that.
Some of my best friends are divine.
Yeah. So it's a nervous place. But it feels like, for instance, when Paul says things like that, that it's the association with Jesus' divinity is something that is reassuring to people who are otherwise left out.
If we go back to the Torah, where, you know, to the Genesis story, of course, we're created in the image of God. So we are instilled with God's divinity. That doesn't stop because of our brokenness. You know, whatever you're going to call it, if you call it sin or alienation or whatever, we are imbued and then also adopted in a sense. You know, baptism is an adoption. But it's real. It's always been there. I think it more than anything baptism does, it reveals who we truly are. We are children of God. And that means that we are divine, that the divine spark in some way resides in each and every one of us.
So we're staying with your question here, and that's helpful. So in other words, when we listen to and read the Bible, Jesus is Son of God, and we're children of God, and we understand those two things differently. Right? Mm-hmm. Children of God is sort of kind of in touch with God. But when Jesus is Son of God, which is almost the same word, mm-hmm. it's a big deal. Paul says, we are sons,
yes.
Forgive the sexism. We are sons because Jesus is Son. So that's, in other words, that's not saying children of God is something different than Son of God. For Paul, Jesus is the big child of God, and so are we in Jesus. I'm not saying you can pull it off. I'm saying I think that there is, that's part of the early Christ movement's consciousness is, oh, we actually are a part of God.
But we are also wiped clean all the time.
Say more.
Yeah.
Say more.
We are wiped clean all the time. We are sinners, but yet we are forgiven immediately, and because of Jesus.
Uh-huh. And would you put? Can you put divinity in that sentence somewhere?
I can put divinity in that sentence because it's like, because Jesus was without sin, we are without sin. And are wiped clean and become, it's kind of a circular.
Thank you. No, that's right.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's exactly what Paul says in Romans 6:11.
Yes.
You paraphrased it.
So I was back thinking about this divinity thing, and as I wrote the I am statement. And as you think about that, it comes with a certain reluctance for me, because it comes with a lot of responsibility to acknowledge mm-hmm. that part, right? Mm-hmm. And then also, as I continued my I am statements, I realized the messiness of it all. And I thought that was really an interesting, that was interesting. I'm going to be thinking more about that.
And let's just, those of us who were here this morning, remember how messy Jesus' divinity is mm-hmm. in the Gospel of Mark.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Totally problematic.
I have a fundamental question. The words are not quite saying it, but that's what I mean. Why are our deities human-like, but perfect in power over everything?
Yeah, that's a great question, because this figure is not. Neither Jesus nor neither the scriptural Jesus nor this figure are. So yeah, that your question is prompted by this strikingly unashamed divine figure that isn't perfect.
Well, it's prompted the last 20 years.
Well, it's, you know, what many theologians say is that idea of the perfectly powerful, wise God ended with the Holocaust. In other words, once, it's not just because of the Holocaust, but because of the Holocaust and all of the similar consciousness of God not being in total control, or if God is in total control, God is not totally good.
I'll take option number one.
Yeah.
That's not an option.
Yeah.
You've got another drum.
Yes.
But what I want to say is, in thunder and in Jesus, you have a vulnerable, humiliated divinity. That also says, well, I mean, for me, the favorite one is, I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness. It's not straightforward boldness, it's boldness with a kind of a tremble to it.
I appreciate the word conundrum.
And you want to say why?
It's just the way I've been feeling when listening to you talk about all this. It's confusing.
Okay.
Well, you know, that was an interesting question. I think that it is us, we as humans, who want God to be perfect. And if we are made in God's image and we are not perfect, then how can we expect God to be perfect? And we continue to strive for perfection, and yet we will never attain it. So I don't think it's wrong to think of God as imperfect.
And yeah, thank you. And it's really interesting, this is the last thing because I'm over time, I know. It's really interesting that it looks like the early Christ people were quite comfortable with that. With a broken, somewhat powerful, ashamed, and humiliated God. And then all of a sudden, Christianity turns into the completely powerful, completely all-knowing God. So I'm really interested in the brokennesses that we know in the world in reclaiming some of the ancient Christian stuff, both inside and outside the Bible. Thanks a lot. Tomorrow, in the late morning, we're talking about this teenage, early Christian heroine, Thecla. A teenage girl who was one of the most popular figures in Christianity in the second century.